Welcome to Spotlight, a show for Relay FM members where I, Kathy Campbell, interview hosts and ask them anything. This month, I get to talk to GitHub Senior Developer Advocate. Wow. Senior, I can speak, I swear, let me. I get to talk to a GitHub Senior Developer Advocate, one of the three hosts of Rocket, and the first class only, Christina Warren. Hi, Christina.
Hey, Kathy, how are you?
I'm doing absolutely fantastic. I'm so excited that you're here, and I'm excited to ask you a ton of questions from our Discord. Members, if you're listening to this right now, next month, I don't know who I'll be interviewing yet, but don't worry, we will announce it in the Discord, and you can ask your questions in the Discord just using question mark, ask Spotlight, and then it'll get sent into my fancy spreadsheet, and I can then ask our hosts anything. Let's get started, Christina. Your Twitter and Instagram handle is film_girl.
Yes.
And Ryan would like to know, what's the story behind that?
Okay, so the story is when you sign up for an online service like Twitter when you're in college, you should probably not use the online handle you've been using since high school. So that's the real story. So I studied film in college. I was a film major. I went to film school. My degree is in pop culture, which, given what I do now, is weird, but at the time, that was kind of the goal. I was like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, working in Hollywood, or I'm going to be like a entertainment attorney or something. And then those things didn't happen. Although I do still love the film industry and Hollywood and all that stuff. But that had been like an online handle that I'd had, like going back to high school, like, you know, on like forums and in LiveJournal and things like that. So that's the story behind the username. And it was one of those things that when I signed up for Twitter in 2007, I think I could have actually had @Christina, which in retrospect, you know, I obviously should have taken. And, you know, well, okay, I'm of two minds of it. On the one hand, it would have been amazing to have. On the other hand, I have friends who are @Justin and @Kendall and @Chris.
Yeah.
And I know what their lives have been like. Like my friend who's @Justin on a number of different social networks, but between like Justin Bieber, Justin Timberlake, Justin Trudeau, like all those things, like his mentions are garbage. Instagram once accidentally, or they claim it was accidentally, I don't know, but his account somehow was given over to Justin Bieber, like the handle was. And he got it back, but it was, you know, it was like a problem. And like at one point, you know, Twitter had to have a huge amount of server like space, like dedicated just to Justin Bieber's mentions. And I'm sure that my Justin got a ton of those, you know, incorrectly. So on the one hand, I'm mad that I don't have @Christina. On the other hand, it probably, you know, is better that I'm something different, like @ChristinaWarren would have been too long. @film_girl is, this is the what kills me. It's the same number of characters as @Christina would have been.
Oh my gosh.
So, which, you know, Twitter, like it winds up mattering, especially in the old days when it was 140 characters, like it really mattered what your username was. So that, you know, that's what kills me. The funny thing is, so I've been a GitHub user since 2009, like really early into the service. I was like one of the first 100,000 users or something. And when I signed up to that, again, I'm fairly confident I could have had @Christina as my handle, but instead I chose @filmgirl, but it's filmgirl one word because GitHub doesn't let you use underscores as usernames. Here's the thing though. You're like, when you're a GitHub employee, your username is how people refer to you. Like it's your email, it's your everything. And I obviously had the option when I joined GitHub to like
create
a new account. I was like, I'm not doing that. So my professional identity, everything is just wrapped up in Film Girl. So at this point, it's really funny that like I have, you know, like if I do get business cards, and I haven't yet, but if I get business cards, they will have filmgirl@github.com on them as my email, which I won't lie, is kind of amazing. And now I've just sort of had to embrace the fact that, yep, mistakes were made. Things that you choose when you're in college will go on to define your professional life. And it makes me like laugh for like the you know, Gen Z kids today who are choosing things like, you know, like soccer mommy and stuff like that. That I
right.
which is hilarious. Like I love the subversiveness there. But I'm thinking, I'm like, oh God, this is going to be really, really funny in a few years when you enter the workforce if you wind up still using any of those handles.
It's so funny how, well, and nowadays too, people, these kids these days, I know my child changes their username all the time because a lot of the software, like, you know, TikTok, you can change your name. It's not a big deal. And I'm just like, what would our lives have been if the programs that we used allowed that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I the one thing I am grateful for is that, like, my very first online handle, I think it was, like, TV Freak with a PH. And if that had been, like, my Twitter handle or something like that, I think I would have had to change. Like, I don't think that I, like, Film Girl, I can kind of, like, at this point, I've embraced it. It's fine. But I think if I was, like, TV Freak with, like, a PH, I don't know if I'd be able to, you know, function.
Like, live with professionally. That. Yeah.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, I think that I would have had to be the boring Christina.Warren person or whatever. and so, at the very least, it's not boring, but I do have to answer that question a lot to people. And I'm like,
I can imagine.
Yeah. And I'm like, no. I'm like, I was in college. I don't know. You know, I like movies. I don't know.
Right? Like, how do you answer that as a, if you don't want to go through, you know, we've been talking about this for 7 minutes now. Right. If you don't want to go through like a 6.5 minute explanation, do you just say, I like films? I like movies?
Yeah, basically. I say, yeah, I like movies. And I, you know, I made poor decisions when I was in college is basically how it's like the long and the short of it, basically. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. All right. Well, living in the past a little bit longer, Erin wants to know, how did you get into podcasting?
Gosh. Okay. So I was an early adopter of listening to podcasts. You know, I used to plug in my iPod and use iTunes. And I think even before that, you know, there were like before iTunes had official support, there were like various services that you could like find things for and download to them. And I was a really big fan of the medium basically from the beginning. I was like, oh, I like this, you know, because radio shows, but more customized, and you find different topics that people would want to talk about. And I think that I did one when I was in college that does not exist anymore anywhere, which is awesome. but when I started blogging, and I one of my first blogging jobs was for TUAW, TUA, the unofficial Apple weblog, rest in peace. And that was a Apple news site that was big in the aughts. And that website had a thing that we called it TalkCast, because we were using a service called TalkCast, which basically would let multiple people record a podcast, and then people could also call in a number and you know, share their own thoughts. And so we started doing one of those, like, on Sundays. I think the show had already existed when I joined the site in 2007. And so I started doing that on Sundays with Mike Rose and some other folks. And that was kind of the beginning. So, yeah, it goes all the way back again to kind of, like, my college days of Mac blogging, and that's how it started.
And how has it changed being a podcaster? How has it changed for you over the years?
Oh gosh, I mean, well, first of all, you can get paid to do it now, right? which early on, you know, that was not a thing. It's also become, it's interesting to see that the industry has really just completely changed. Like, I think in the early days, a lot of the stuff, it was very much more kind of a DIY ethos and very much an effort of love. Obviously, production quality has gotten significantly better. Once you started to see, and it happened, I would say probably like the late aughts, you know, early 2010s is when you started to see the first wave of advertiser-sponsored things come into it. And then you started to see, I think, the professional quality go up, and you had things even earlier than that, like Leo Laporte, who I've been on his shows for years and I was a fan of his even longer, you know, obviously, brought in, some professional, isms, I guess, kind of to the concept. But you did start to see, I think, like the lines between radio and podcasting started to blur quite a bit. That's happened where a lot of the audio talent, the people who, you know, 20 years ago, they were making, you know, NPR shows or other types of, you know,
radio content. Public,
exactly, radio content. And now those people, I think, you know, you make audio content, you make podcasts, and you do daily things that way. I think that's one of the biggest changes. I would say another area that's changed is that for the first, I would say, solid decade of podcasting, tech content was definitely the primary content that at least you would find with popular podcasts, right? Like you would have a tech-related podcast, which for me worked really well because that's what I did. But now with that tech podcasts are, you know, our network is, I think, one of the exceptions that's still largely tech-focused. A lot more of it is lifestyle, right? A lot more of it is news and lifestyle, true crime, you know, like, you know, other types of things. And so it's, you know, daily news rundowns, you know, kind of about TV recap podcasts. Like it's the expansiveness has really changed. But like Serial, I think, from, you know, This American Life really set things in motion, I think, for really expanding what the genre can do. And Earwolf, similarly for comedy. And frankly, for as much as people might not want to hear this, but it's true, Joe Rogan for, you know, the type of Howard Stern and sort of, you know, daily commentary stuff, like all those things, I think really changed the medium in a lot of respects from being, you know, kind of this kind of nerdy thing that initially the only people who were doing this were people who were maybe technically inclined enough to both find and listen to the podcast, but also create it, right?
Yeah, because you had to have a certain level of technical experience to even get them to figure out how to listen. And you definitely needed technical experience to be able to produce them and publish it, because you didn't have Anchor or any of these like amazing, magical, whatever software that you just plug a file in, and it was harder to get, you know, a microphone to come and make it sound good, let alone the software to produce it. Like it makes complete sense that as the technical needs easier to access, then the podcast that became more popular also became less technical required almost. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. And you got like, I mean, early on people were, I think, trying to break into those other areas, but it didn't really, you didn't have like kind of the mass attention around those things.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny now that we're thinking about this. I remember my TiVo, for people who remember TiVo. TiVo had podcast support probably in 2006.
Wow.
And which TiVo was really ahead of its time in a lot of ways. But it was, even then, a lot of the content was kind of like tech related, because that was just like the stuff that was going to be the best. But you're right. As things have become easier and more accessible to do, and it's less complicated to have to figure out how to listen to a podcast, you know, now you just open up, you know, whatever app you're using, whereas before it was, okay, I need to find this certain tab in iTunes, I need to download these files and then listen to it. And
you know, you needed a computer that was connected to the internet.
Right.
To be able to do it. And now you can, you know, be walking in Central Park and download a new podcast. And
absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Amazing. I just love the podcasting genre and the history of it. It's just so interesting to me. And then how it influences people's lives and daily careers. And Marlies wants to know, how has being a podcaster influenced your career?
Gosh, I mean, I think that it honestly has had a big impact on my career. So I was writing about technology, I was blogging and then writing about technology before I was podcasting, but the two kind of have coincided. Like my podcasting career has definitely followed my professional career, and I definitely think it's helped my professional career. I would say, so when I went to Mashable in 2009, which is the news publication that I worked at the longest, that was in the early days of Mashable. The site had been around for a few years, but when I joined, it was right when it started switching to actually like trying to be a professional news site and not just hiring some freelancers. They were like, okay, we're actually going to hire full-time people. We're going to get health insurance. We're going to like make a go at this thing. And I think I was like employee number 9 or something. And it was interesting because that was right at kind of like the cusp of like digital media becoming a thing and becoming viable. And podcasting was definitely a part of that. And I'd had this experience for TOAW and then working with some other people. Like I was working with a guy named Dan Benjamin early on when he was launching kind of his podcast network and things like that. And so I had this level of experience that did help me when I would then be asked to do podcasts and other things for my day job, which became more frequent. I would also say it helped a ton when I started doing live TV appearances, because there was a time when I was going on TV quite a bit. I was going on CNN and CNBC and Fox Business and, you know, sometimes like the Today Show and things like that quite a lot. And having experience doing live audio, it's different than doing live television, but it is also similar in the sense that you have to know how to think on your feet. You have to be able to keep a conversation moving. It's right. Good training in that regard. And then I wound up producing podcasts, you know, at Mashable and at Gizmodo, places like that. I was at Microsoft. I did a podcast at Microsoft with the CTO behind the tech with Kevin Scott. We've been doing Rocket for 6.5 years. It's definitely helped my career, I think, a ton. I think there are a lot of people. I can go back as far back as 2010. I remember being at a conference and someone recognizing my voice.
Wow.
From podcasts, which was freaky, but cool. And to this day, like I have people who, you know, when I've joined companies, like when I joined Microsoft and again, when I joined GitHub, getting messages from people internally at the company being like, oh, I know you from Twit. I know you from This Week in Tech. I've listened to you for years, is really cool. And so it's had a massive influence on my career, I think, in terms of making me more comfortable to be able to do things like live television. And then that extends to my current job where, you know, I do a lot of live speaking and event hosting and things like that. So it's helped a ton with that. And I think also just helped like my visibility, definitely helped my visibility as a journalist, I think, because more and more people were aware of podcasts and I've been lucky enough to build up a little bit of a following and people who know me from the audio realm. So it's helped a ton. Like it's had a massive impact on my career and I'm super, super grateful for it. And it's hard for me to actually, in some ways, like I think like not have podcasting and the rest of my professional career intertwined because the two have followed each other. Basically, like I was in college when I started doing this stuff through, you know, my career now. I've kind of grown up with it. In a way.
So just like film_girl followed you, so did podcasting.
Absolutely.
Both of them are a big part of your life.
Yeah.
I love that. So Ryan is wondering, what made you want to pivot from journalism to developer advocacy?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. So, I mean, there are kind of two answers. One is kind of the pragmatic answer, which is the media industry is, can we curse on this members feed or no?
No.
Okay. Yeah. So the media industry is kind of a dumpster fire. And it is an ish show, so to speak. So that's one part of it, which is that I was never concerned, too much about like my job security. Like I figured if I ever got laid off, I more than likely would be able to find another job and that's fine. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I felt confident that if I got laid off, as so many of my talented friends and colleagues have over the years, I felt confident I could find another job, but it's not a great kind of place to be in, especially for career growth. I'd kind of reached a ceiling where I was like, okay, if I want to go any higher, I'm probably going to have to go into management, which I didn't know if I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know if I was, you know, frankly, like there are only so many people who are like that top echelon of reporters. And I didn't know if I could break through to that or not. So that was one part of it. And then another part of it was, you know, I got the opportunity when a recruiter reached out to me to join Microsoft, and it was interesting, and I hadn't ever thought about that before. I mean, I kind of had, but I thought, well, if I went to a tech company, I'd have to be like a comms person. I'd have to be, you know, in communications or in PR or something, and that didn't really interest me.
Right, because that's what your experience was.
Right, right. And that didn't interest me, honestly. That didn't seem like much of a challenge or that interesting, and when it was then like, no, it will be this other thing, and you actually have skills that can be used in this other way, that became really interesting. And so I think that, like, for my career growth, like, I've always been a geek. I've always done development, especially web development stuff, you know, in my spare time, but it was never my day job. But I've always loved telling developer stories, and I've always definitely been in touch with that audience, like, naturally. Like, it's not a put on. Like, I've read Hacker News and things like that in the morning, and I care about, right, you know, changes to APIs, and I get, you know, angry when devs get angry about things, and I like creating content, and I like being able to, like, tell stories. And so it was actually kind of a perfect fit for me to do as something that I was like, oh, I can take my skill set of being a storyteller, of being a communicator, of being somebody who's connected to these communities, and do something that is not PR or comms. And there's nothing wrong with either of those things at all. I would just be bored if I did that, to be completely honest. There wouldn't be any challenge. Whereas there is a challenge in having to learn new tech all the time and figure out how to explain it and figure out, you know, what you can do to break it down. And then because I'm me, I've found ways to even, like, bring a news component into it. I do a weekly developer news YouTube show that I've done for a couple of years, and, you know, things like that. Like, I bring the other parts of my personality into it. But, you know, it was a new challenge, new opportunities, definitely more potential for career growth, both financially and just in terms of where I can take my career. And then just kind of the general state of the media industry, which is not great. It's not a great place. And it was one of those things where, yeah, I hadn't planned on leaving, and then, but I got the opportunity, and I was like, well, you know, I guess worst case, I can always go back. But it's been good so far. It's been 5 years, and it's been good so far.
Amazing. Yeah. And trying something new, growing and changing and learning more about yourself and what you can do, and then discovering, you know, new pathways. That's so exciting, and getting to learn something new, because just like you said, you know, you've been in journalism and tech journalism for so long that, yeah,
right.
Oh, you could do it, whatever, you know, sure. Put me on live TV. Absolutely. What, you know, and getting a challenge in something that you're passionate about is pretty exciting.
It is. And I love learning new things. Developer advocacy is great for that, because I have to learn new things all the time. And it's great for me, who I'm a generalist. I don't really focus on one, like, language area or one tech area, which can sometimes be a detriment, but I think it's actually really good for me, because I can break things and I can kind of get deep enough and then pass it off to somebody else who will be able to go further. But it's also been great for me to just have better tech skills. And ironically, I think I'm actually a better tech journalist than I was before, because I have a better understanding of what actually goes into product and engineering teams, especially at larger companies. And I have a different perspective. Like, if I were to go back to full-time journalism tomorrow, I would have a different perspective than I did beforehand. And that doesn't mean I'd be more sympathetic. It just means I would know more things than what I did before. And I would have, like, better, you know, insights into why certain decisions happen. And I think it's actually made me a better podcaster in that sense too, because when new stories and things come up, I can still share my opinions, but it's colored a little bit by having the experience that I have. And it's also, it's been great to learn new things. And I've always loved to tell developer stories. That's always been something I've been passionate about. And now I still get to do that, but I also get to, I feel like, advocate for developers, you know, internally, you know, at companies where developers use a lot of their products. And that means I can hopefully have an impact on, you know, their day-to-day workflows, which is really cool.
All right. Jack Wellborn says, a former employer of mine once suggested I give them my Twitter credentials so the marketing team could promote said employer. Vomit emoji.
Oh, God.
While your situation is very different, how do you navigate between keeping your voice while promoting the likes of Microsoft and GitHub?
Great question, Jack. And it can be difficult. I think the first thing is sort of setting boundaries. And this is a hard one for me in some cases, because I was lucky that I had my online identities before I joined Mashable and then Gizmodo and then Microsoft and whatnot. But definitely I was very aware of the fact that I was hired at all those places in part because of my number of Twitter followers. When I joined Mashable, I think, and this was 2009, I think I had 10,000 Twitter followers, which was a lot back then. And that was definitely a reason why I was hired. I definitely know it helped me when I got my job at Microsoft. And I know that at GitHub, they definitely appreciate it. But it is a difficult thing to say, okay, where do I draw the line between my voice and theirs? And I was at Mashable for 7 years. And there was a period of time when I think most of my tweets were just promoting Mashable stories. And I didn't really have a lot of growth in terms of followers and engagement and things like that, because I was promoting someone else's brand and not mine. And I kind of woke up from that one at one point. I think I got mad at them. I think they yelled at me about something and I got angry. And then I kind of was like, what are you doing? This is mine. This doesn't belong to someone else. And so now when I go into these things, I definitely want to help out the places that I'm working for and want to promote things. But I make it very clear from the beginning to be like, I will do this, but I'm not going to promote anything and everything. You do not get my login. You do not own this. If you wanted to own this, then you could buy it. And it has a price. And it's a multiple of my salary. But you could buy this from me, but it does not belong to you. And then also figuring out, okay, I'm only going to promote what I feel comfortable with. I've said, to Microsoft, to GitHub, I will do you the courtesy of not disparaging the company products on my account. But that does not mean that I'm going to promote or say that everything is good, because that's not true. And I don't like everything. And that would lose the trust and credibility that people who follow me know. And I think that when I joined Microsoft, I think a lot of people were probably concerned or expected that I was just going to become a shill for them. Right. And that didn't happen. people would go, you're going to have to give up all your Apple products. And I was like, first of all, I joined Microsoft in 2017. They weren't making phones anymore. They right. weren't doing that stuff. They bought me a MacBook, right? I went into my interview. They knew what was up. They knew I was an Applebee reporter. They knew the score. And if anything, for the work that I do, having authenticity is super important. Because if you're not being authentic, then developers can smell that and they're going to be turned off. So I think that's actually part of it too, is figuring out, explaining to the people who, want to use you to promote things, that if you're just going to be kind of a shill, it's not going to work. It's going to vary on who your audience is, but I think I can't think of any audience where that would be something that would just work, right? Yeah. I think there's some celebrities, if you're Taylor Swift, she could tell us all to go, buy something terrible. And she could promote the stuff that the Kardashians promote. And we'd be like, yes, Taylor, we're going to buy that flat tummy tea. We're going to do it. You go, girl. Yeah. We wouldn't even flinch. But I think that for a lot of other people, it would definitely be, one of those things where that you do things like that, that's not going to work. And so I think that definitely figuring out with your employer, what the lines are, making it clear that you own your social media content and that you're only promoting what you're comfortable with. And if they want you to do more than that, then get paid for it.
Yes.
Period. That's the other thing. You own it. What I kind of realized was my social media accounts and brand, quote unquote, and following and whatnot, it's going to outlast the company, almost positively, the company, the amount of time that I work at a certain company, right? My reputation, my brand is going to be there after. So that means I need to be really careful about what I'm doing and make sure that I'm proud of what I'm saying, that I stand behind it. And I would say the same thing to you, Jack. What you have and what you've built will go beyond your employer. And if they want to use it and you're not comfortable with it, well, they can buy it out from you. Otherwise, like, no bueno.
Big Lou would like to know, what's a typical day in the life for you?
Gosh, okay, so it varies. But I wake up and I log on to one of my mini computers and I get onto Slack and I, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm having meetings in Zoom or in other things, and sometimes I'm creating content. Sometimes I'm writing scripts to record a video or a podcast. So it sort of depends. But a lot of it is meetings and then just figuring out like what types of content we're going to be creating and what sorts of things we're going to be doing. Sometimes I might be like, this has been less common in the last 2 years, but will hopefully become more common in the future. Sometimes I'm in other countries. And then I have to, you know, give talks at either, you know, at events or to meetup groups or to both. And so, you know, it's figuring out, okay, what do my demos look like? What are my slides going to be? Have I rehearsed my talk? You know, that sort of thing. But a lot of it, I mean, honestly, I try to keep my pulse on everything that's happening online. Like, it's so funny. A big part of my job is Twitter and keeping up with those things. Not to say that I get paid to tweet, because that's not true, unfortunately, but it is true in the sense that, like, I'm keeping up with what the conversation is on various, you know, networks and platforms and figuring out, okay, like, what's going on? What type of content do we need to be creating? It's different than news. News was, in one sense, kind of easier and harder in the sense that the news never stops. So you never know what you're going to be doing on any given day, because the news doesn't stop, for better or for worse. Corporate life works slower, which is cool, but it also, because of the things that I do, it can vary from day to day. Like, I'm looking at my calendar today and I have some various meetings set up. I'm actually recording another podcast at my lunch hour. I have some other meetings later this afternoon, and then I'll be, you know, writing my script and preparing my content for a video that I record tomorrow that will go up on Friday. We're recording this on a Wednesday, and I record a video on Thursdays that go up on Fridays. So it just sort of depends.
Busy, 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 but always different. Always makes every day exciting instead of boring.
Yeah, no, definitely. If I had, like, I don't know. If I had like a normal 9-to-5, I don't know if I could function that way, to be honest.
All right. Steven, our Steven, is asking, what is the best Mac of the PPC, Intel, and Silicon eras?
Okay. Of the PowerPC era, it is definitely the iMac, the G3, the G4, the classic iMac with the telescopic screen, like the flat screen, flat screen iMac, right? Like, that's like the greatest Mac of all time, in my opinion. It's the most beautiful. I would use one of those forever. For the Intel, I'm gonna say the black MacBook is my favorite ever. I don't know if it's the best Mac, like, in terms of all arounderness, but it's my ultimate favorite. Like, I love the black book. That's another laptop that I would absolutely still rock if they made one today, and I wish they would. Even plastic, I don't care. Like, yeah, I would love it. And then for Apple Silicon, I think like the 14-inch MacBook Pro Max is a near perfect laptop. Like, I have both the 14-inch and the 16-inch, because I'm lucky. Work got me a 16-inch, and I have my personal 14-inch. I love that 16-inch, and like, as a desktop replacement, I think it's the best. But the 14-inch is definitely more portable, and it is one of the best laptops that I've had in years. It's like, they basically, you know, the 16-inch is basically the old 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, but modernized, and the 14-inch is like better than the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. And it's just a great machine. So those are my picks. The iMac G4, the Black Book, and the 14-inch MacBook Pro Max.
All right, Mike Hurley.
Yes.
I guess he can ask a question.
I guess so.
He's asking, what's your favorite usage of a Mac on a TV show?
Oh gosh, that's a great question, Mike. Okay, Carrie Bradshaw. Sex and the City, iconic. I mean, you know, Jerry Seinfeld famously used a Mac, and I famously this is back when Hulu had the rights to Seinfeld. So this is how far long ago this was. This was 7 years ago. They created a pop-up apartment in New York City where they recreated like the season 8 Seinfeld apartment. And they did a really great job with everything, except they had a freaking PC in the corner. And I went like early for like a media day, and I noticed that immediately, and we were taking photos, and I wrote like a blog post basically like decrying this. And I basically bullied them into running to some sort of, you know, store, like thrift shop.
Steven's little hut to steal the right.
Right. And they still didn't get the right, like for season 8, they still didn't get the right Mac, but they got a Mac at least. And I was like, I will take it.
Fine.
But I basically bullied them into fixing it. So like Seinfeld, I think in the background was always great. In movies, I think, you know, like Mission Impossible, like that 5300 power book, which was actually a terrible power book. Like it was actually one that had like massive like heat problems and other issues. But the Mission Impossible power book was great. Also in movies, the very terrible, like awful, like I saw it when I was like in third grade. It was a terrible movie. I loved it as a kid, but it's an awful movie. Blank Check, where the kid like writes himself a blank check for he gets a blank check from some crook, and he writes himself like $1 million, and he's Mr. McIntosh. But Carrie Bradshaw, you know, Sex and the City, like name a more iconic Mac user. You can't. Like that is, I mean, there's
maybe Elle Woods.
Yeah, Elle Woods.
Maybe.
But like Sex and the City, like Carrie wrote everything on that. Yeah. Right. And like there was the episode where her Pismo, her Wall Street, power book, died, and Aiden went to, God, I can't think of the name right now, but it was the famous TechServe in New York City, which RIP. You know, she had to take it there to get repaired, and he tried to get her the Blueberry iBook, similar the same model that Elle Woods had, but just in a different color. And he was like, "Look, it's like a purse, it has a handle." She's like, "No, I don't want it." You know, so I think Carrie Bradshaw, Sex and the City, the MacBook. They even had when the first movie came out, HBO or Warner Brothers, I guess, made like a website like Carrie's MacBook that like you could explore her desktop and read certain things like emails and whatnot. And it was kind of a precursor for like the world around the movie. And it was really funny because HP was a big sponsor of that film, but they had to have it so that Carrie still used a Mac because they knew, they were like, no, this is like an intrinsic part of this character.
Yeah.
So yeah.
The world would like explode if Carrie used a PC. Like,
no, 100%. There's
no way.
What I really appreciated about the rebooted series and just like that was that she was using an older Intel MacBook. Like it still had like a glowing Apple. Because Carrie doesn't upgrade her tech. Like she was using a BlackBerry and she was using an older MacBook. And I was like, yes, this is a show that still understands the character and the tech. Like this is exactly who she would be. It doesn't matter how much money she has. She's not using something new because she doesn't.
She wouldn't.
She doesn't know any better. She doesn't know that, you know, she's going to use like, it's going to be like an every decade thing. Like the laptop finally dies and she's going to have to take it into the Apple store and they're going to have to, you know, get her a new one. Because it's just, you know, she's not using it for anything other than like, this is what I know about how to write my things in. I'm not, you know, I'm kind of a Luddite in other ways. So yeah, I think that's my favorite.
Good choice. Good choice. All right. Marlies is asking, if you can force Apple to start making one of their products in rose gold, which do you choose? And the answer cannot be everything, even though I'm team rose gold too. Like that would be my answer. So I knew that's what you would pick. So I have to
totally
only pick one.
I think that I would love to see either like the pro versions of the phones, or honestly, like the laptops. Like we have the iMac 24, you know, is available in pink, so that's close enough. But like I need like a 14-inch like MacBook Pro, like in rose gold. Like I really do. Like it's annoying to me that like, and I love like the new MacBook Air, like that has the starlight color. Again, that's goldish. It's fine. I would love more pink. But why do they make it only like the consumer, super consumer products available and the fun colors. Like to me, it was iconic when like you could get the phones, like the flagship phones in rose gold, you know, they made a pink iPhone. Yes. Like I'd love to see a pink iPhone back again, but honestly, like I would love to have, if I can't get a black MacBook, I would love a rose gold MacBook.
Ugh, preach. Like why? We want fun colors.
We do. We do. I mean,
professional users deserve fun colors.
They do. And I mean, and it goes back, you know, kind of like to the iPod, you know, like the Nano and the Shuffle, you know, had colors and, you know, you could even get like the iPod Video and Classic and Black. And like, I don't know, it's just, it'd be nice. It'd be nice if they would, you know, kind of embrace the color lifestyle again. Yeah. You know, like Johnny Ive is not in the building at all anymore. So like, let's just embrace the fact that like pro users like to have fun too. We're the ones who spend all the money. Come on. Like,
let us have fun.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ugh. Seriously. Peter is like, would like to know, what's your favorite scam of all time? And what scam would you be best at running?
Ooh. Okay. This is a great question. My favorite scam of all time. Theranos is pretty good. But I think Anna Delvey, at least of kind of recent scams, is my favorite. Just the audaciousness of it. And just the fact like she got so close to getting the money, like getting the banks to just sign over the money on nothing but Ingenuity. I have to give her credit for that. Like, I'm sorry for what she did to like Rachel Deloach Williams. But other than her, like, I kind of like everybody else, I'm kind of like, whatever. Like, you didn't do your due diligence. It's on you. I also think like Enron was a really interesting financial scam. Like if you look into like how they cooked the books on that, like the mark-to-market accounting and the use of Sarbanes-Oxley and some other things, like was really smart in terms of things that was definitely not above board but looked close enough that it was masking, you know, a lot of problems, and very intelligent in that regard. In terms of things to be best at, I think it'd be if I had like no ethics and you know, would be okay with living with myself this way, I think you'd be great at doing a crypto pump and dump, man. I think I'd be great at doing that. I think I'd be really, really good at being able to pump up, you know, some sort of like altcoin and then like do a rug pull. Like that, I think I'd be excellent.
Yes. But of course, would never do such a thing.
No, unfortunately.
Ever. Not even thinking about it. Yeah. Darn ethics.
I know. That are NFTs. Like, honestly, it'd be like a combo. Like, it'd be like an NFT, like, you know, a crypto altcoin kind of combo sort of thing. I think I'd be great at one of those. But yeah, unfortunately, I have ethics and morals and can't do it.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
All right. John Boharv would like to ask, who would you want to play you in a limited TV series version of your life?
Oh, Anne Hathaway. No question.
Great answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. All right. Mike is wondering, what is the best plane seat you've ever experienced and which airline does the best job?
Oh, great question, Mike. Okay. So the best seat I've ever had, I was very lucky. I upgraded myself. I should note this. This was not like a work paid for thing, like some of the people I'm blind got mad about. But I flew Singapore Air. It was only a 7-hour flight. This was the disappointing thing. But I flew from Australia to Singapore in the suites, the Singapore Air suites. And this is like their first class suite where like you have your own completely like private room. And they have like, there's like a caviar course. And like I had like lobster, like Thermidor for like dinner and like expensive champagne. And like they literally just kiss your butt. Like they will do anything for you. It was amazing. I will say though, and that was very expensive. And I like upgraded myself from like business class to first class. And most international airlines, US ones anyway, like do not have a differentiation like anything above business class, but some of the Asian and some of the Middle Eastern airlines do have a first class. And in some planes, like it's not much of a difference, but you have a few things like Etihad and Emirates and especially like Singapore and Etihad are the two I think that probably have the highest end from everything I've read, like first class experiences. And the Singapore Air, the suite was amazing. It was unreal. I have to say though, I think that for something more attainable, Qatar Airlines is Q Suites, which is their business class. If you're going anywhere that goes through Doha and you can get a Q Suite, that was definitely an amazing seat. It's you have a door. It's not like a completely enclosed space like the Singapore suites, but it is similar to the Delta suites, where you have like a sliding door that closes and a full layback seat. And the Qatar video system is amazing. There's even an HDMI port, so you can plug in, you know, your iPad or your laptop and like use their, you know, big 20-inch screen or 24-inch screen or whatever. It's ridiculous. In terms of airlines that do the best job, I think that for U.S. airlines, I think Delta is probably, well, they're my favorite and they're who I use, but I've flown all of them. But I think they're probably the most consistent. But again, I have to give the Middle Eastern airlines like major credit, because they're subsidized in part by the government. So they do a really good job. Like I flew Turkish Airlines recently, not even like in the full on like high-end business class or anything, but just like one leg was going from Israel to going from Copenhagen to Istanbul, and the next leg was Istanbul to Tel Aviv. And I got like full-on meals on both of those flights, and like one of them was like, wow, it was like an under 2-hour flight, and I got like a full-on meal, like better than you would get on like an 8-hour domestic U.S. airline flight, right? Like you know, like
right,
full-on thing. And an amazing service. So I think that any of the Middle Eastern airlines, because I haven't flown Etihad, but I've flown the others, and I've flown Emirates and Qatar and Singapore and Turkish now, Singapore's not Middle East, but some of the Asian airlines again are really good. But those are the airlines that really know how to treat you. For U.S. domestic stuff, I think Delta. But for international stuff, if you can fly any of the Asian, Korean Air, not so much, but like any of the Japanese airline, or if you can fly Singapore, or if you can fly any of the Middle Eastern airlines, you will have an amazing experience. Because like I said, like domestic first class on Turkish was better than some like international first classes I've had, or international, wow, business classes I've had, you know, on other airlines, just in terms of the service and definitely in terms of the food.
And when I get there, I want to know, what is the favorite hotel room that you've ever visited?
Oh gosh, this is a great question. So I've been lucky to have some really good upgrades. I think my favorite, I was in Toronto, and I was at, I think it was, I was at the St. Regis. I think I was at the St. Regis in Toronto, and I got upgraded to some sort of ridiculous like suite with a butler, and the bathroom floor was heated.
Wow.
And which I'd never experienced before. That was amazing. And yeah, and it was like a full on like room. There was like TV screens like built into the mirrors. Like it was ridiculous. Like it was just this really, really great room. And again, like butler service. Like there was a guy basically hosted outside my door who would like do anything I wanted. It was,
wow,
unreal. So that was amazing. In terms of like actual like rooms that I've been upgraded to, I have to say, when I was in India, I got upgraded. Like my room when I was in Mumbai was about the size of my apartment. That's not a joke. And it was like massive, and I was there for a week, so it was really nice, but it was just like gigantic, and you get a lot more for your money obviously in some other parts of the world. But I think my favorite room ever was the St. Regis in Toronto, and that was a really, really nice upgrade. I will also say, very recently I was in Tel Aviv, and I was at the Ritz-Carlton in Herzliya, and I got upgraded to a deluxe room. So it wasn't even a suite, but it was, again, it was like almost 700 square feet. It was a really, really big hotel room. Wow. And it was gorgeous. And I had this amazing view of the beach, and it was just really, really nice. But yeah, that Toronto hotel room, I still think about that, because it was only one night, and I missed my flight the next day because I got stuck in immigration, because you have to clear immigration in the U.S. Or in Canada before you go to the U.S. And I missed my flight had to get on like two other flights to get back, and it was annoying, and I was so mad, because I was like, if I'd known I was going to miss this flight, I would have just stayed in the hotel you know, the rest of the afternoon, because I had 5 p.m. checkout, 4 p.m. checkout. So I would have.
Oh my gosh.
So I would have just done that. And that's honestly what I should have done. But the St. Regis in Toronto, if you want to stay at a great hotel, I don't know what the other rooms are like, because again, I wasn't expecting that. I came in and they were like, oh, thank you for your status. Your room's not ready yet, but we have like this, you know, like suite, whatever thing for you. And it was unreal. Like, I didn't appreciate how the other half lives until I had a heated bathroom floor.
Until you have, in a hotel room.
In a hotel room. And I was like, oh my God. Okay, cool. Thank you.
All right. Two more questions. The Loksta? Loksta? Loksta. He would like to know, what is your favorite Taylor Swift related memory?
Oh gosh, another great question. Okay, so the 1989 tour was really special, and I saw that in New York, or New Jersey, but it was the, you know, New York stop, so to speak. And that was really, really fun. But I also saw it in Los Angeles, and I think my favorite memory was my friend Stephanie knew I was a huge Taylor Swift fan. She's a huge Taylor Swift fan, and she lived in Los Angeles at the time, and she was supposed to go with her roommate and her best friend. Like that Saturday, Taylor was at the Staples Center, and she like contacted me on Tuesday, and she was like, hey, I know it's last minute, but my best friend has to be out of town. I got these amazing floor seats for my birthday from my aunt, and you know, my friend can't come. Do you want to come out? And it was, again, it was like a Tuesday. The concert's on Saturday. Gosh. And you know, I wasn't making tech money then, so, and I didn't have frequent flyer miles like I do now. So I booked a ticket and flew out on Friday, and or Thursday night, I guess I should say. And my boss even like let me have like Friday off, because I was like I'm going to see Taylor. Like, I'm flying across the country to go see Taylor last minute, and we saw Heart at the Hollywood Bowl on Friday, which was awesome. And then we saw Taylor on Saturday at the Staples Center, and that was, and Mary J. Blige was her guest that that tour stop, and that was amazing. And I think that was a just amazing experience. And that was like one of, you know, again, like it was a very last minute. It was expensive, you know. It was like $1,500 probably, like all in for me to, you know, fly across the country that last minute. And again, I wasn't making tech money then. So that was not like a normal occurrence, but it was so much fun. And it was such a great show. And just the fact that like I was like, yep, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to go out. I'm going to do it.
Just do it.
So yeah, that's I think my favorite Taylor memory.
I remember watching that on Instagram. And I'm just like, I just incredible. Just, I was so happy for you. Oh, goodness. Okay. Final question. This one's a little bit serious. So make sure you're ready.
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Skylar is asking, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your favorite color of the alphabet?
My favorite color of the alphabet, I guess, purple tea. I don't know.
Well, but it's on a scale of 1 to 10. So you got to.
I guess 10. 10 purple tea, I guess, is my answer.
Perfect
Skylar.
Answer.
10 purple tea. That's a great question. Really hard to answer, but yeah, 10 purple tea, I think.
Nice. Perfection. Just like every other question that you answered today. Thank you so much, Christina, for taking time out of your super busy schedule, as replied earlier in this podcast episode. Is there anything you want to say to the members or the people in the Discord for asking these great questions?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for listening to the show and supporting all of us over the years and supporting Relay FM. That's really amazing of you, and we're definitely appreciative, and thank you to the Relay family for everything. And also thanks for all the great questions, Discord. Like, these were really fun, and keep following me on Instagram and Twitter and all those things. So, but film underscore girl on the Twitters and the Instagrams, youtube.com/GitHub. I'll plug all those things. Listen to Rocket on Relay FM. But thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. Like, it really means a lot to all of us. When I meet people who have listened to Rocket, like, it honestly makes me so happy. We're all so proud of the show, but we are so thankful for the support and really thankful to the members. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. My very first podcast t-shirt was the Keep It Weird shirt.
Yay. We need to bring back some new Rocket shirts. Yeah.
Yes, you do. Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll talk about that later. Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much for listening, everyone. Once again, if you want to ask questions to future hosts on this show, make sure you join the Discord. You can go to your Memberful account and get signed up. Head on over to the Discord. We would love to have you there. So much fun. Great people. Hang out more than just asking questions to our great hosts. But once again, thank you, Christina, for joining us. And I hope you all have an absolutely amazing day.